Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon on Faith Radio. And there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hello and welcome to today's Connecting Faith. I always appreciate the opportunity to get together with you. I'm Neil Stavem, but we spend some time each day in the program looking at ways we can apply biblical principles to daily life situations to just help connect faith to life. And in our discussion today, Ted, we want to talk more about end of life and just making some connection there to make it more meaningful. We're going to talk today about the good funeral.
Something that normally a lot of people don't talk about, don't like to talk about, death is a part of life, and we're going to address it today.
Well, we were just chatting before the show. Your grandmother had lived a long, good life to, 90-something?
98. She was 5 days away from 99 in December, birthday December 23rd, and then, yes, we laid her to rest a few weeks ago.
Yeah, so this is kind of fresh for you, getting some perspective. So I'm looking forward to hearing our guest's insights today as we talk about The Good Funeral. That's the title of a book that he's co-authored. Subtitle is Death, Grief, and the Community of Care. And our guest is Thomas Long. Tom is a Bandy professor of preaching at the Candler School of Theology at Emory University. And he's authored a number of books, The Witness of Preaching, The Sense of Preaching, Preaching in the Literary Forms of the Bible, and a number of other books, things on Matthew and Hebrews. And today we want to talk about his role as a pastor who is his overseen and shared at a good number of funerals and has been talking about this subject for some time. So, Tom, welcome to Connecting Faith.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
This, if statistics are true, we know that, over the holidays, there is the days and weeks after the Christmas and New Year's holiday, there tends to be an increase in deaths. And so it may be that some of our listeners have just recently gone through this experience, or maybe it is something where there's a diagnosis and they're facing something here sooner than later. And so we just want to talk about some of the what really makes a good funeral, what that means, and maybe just say, before we kind of dive in, say a word about maybe why you wrote this book with your co-author, Thomas Lynch.
Well, I had written an earlier book about the Christian funeral, and Tom Lynch had also written a book about his own work as a funeral director called The Undertaking, and his book attracted my attention, my book attracted his. And so we had an opportunity to meet, and we found out that we were kind of soulmates on things funereal. We drove around Michigan for a while, speaking in various communities to pastors and funeral directors out of our various perspectives, and became friends. And we also had flint and steel as we talked about our ideas, and we said at the end of this, we need to put this into a book. And so that was the origin of The Good Funeral.
We do have some copies to give away, by the way, and as you hear our discussion, if it's something that you think you could really benefit from or would just like to maybe have it available to maybe something even have in your church as well, make it available. You can call in. We'll do a drawing for that at 877-93-FAITH. It's 877-933-2484. So I'm interested to have the basics, I guess maybe we'd call them the rituals of a funeral, changed much over the years, and if so, in what way?
Dramatically so. In fact, one pastor that I interviewed when I was working on the book said that of all the things that he does, all the rituals over which he presides, nothing had changed more in his ministry than the funeral. There are some obvious things that we can see have changed. For example, in America, the cremation rate, once about 3% within memory, is now nearly 50%. And increasing rapidly. It's way over 50% out west and moving east very, very quickly. The body itself, as a the presence of the casketed body at a funeral, has become not the norm anymore. We are the first people in the history of the world for whom the dead are not always welcome at their own funeral services. One change that we can see is our great-grandparents, when someone died in the family, the body would be placed in state in the home, and they even had a room called the parlor where this was done. And then the funeral industry began to develop funeral homes, and they were originally called funeral parlors, so that the dead were laid out there rather than at home, and suddenly the dead disappeared from our experience and our environment, and we renamed those parlors living rooms so that they wouldn't be associated anymore with the dead. So we're seeing a lot of changes. One last one I'll mention is that funerals, which were generally church events or synagogue events, have now become very personalized events, and it would be an unusual thing not to display some photographs and objects related to the deceased and to tell lots of stories, of making a very personal experience out of what was once a worship service.
Hmm. We're going to dive into more of it as we go along, but maybe just for someone that has found themselves in the position where they needed to be involved in planning one or putting one together, what's the biggest surprise maybe or aspect of a funeral that people maybe are unprepared for, would you say?
Well, I think there are several things. When you ask that question out in the larger culture, people are unprepared for the kind of cost of things. Even if you do cremation and minimize the cost, there can be a sudden unexpected expense on a family that some are not prepared for. There's also the depth of grief that one sometimes does not anticipate. And going through the process of planning a funeral and bringing up the memories of the deceased and thinking through what that life meant can be a very a heart-wrenching experience for a lot of people. There's one that unexpected thing that intrigues me very much, and that is that we've moved in our time to a notion that funerals ought to be radically different for each person who has died, as if somehow the time-honored ways of doing this are no longer helpful, and each and every funeral has to be monogrammed and personalized in some very unique way. And that can sometimes be a burden, not a freedom. We try to think, how can we make this different from all the funerals that we've been to?
Well, you said that changing it from a worship service, and even as you said about it, now we are emphasizing unique. I suppose it's like weddings where there was sort of the standard, order of service, and the vows were the same out of a prayer book. So is it the same sort of thing where we've decided to sort of throw away the pastor's maybe handbook on how to do a funeral?
Yeah, I think that's right. The pendulum, I think, has swung from one extreme over to the other. It would never have occurred to the Puritans, for example, in America, that somebody ought to plan their own funeral. Funerals were something that were done for everybody in the same way. They were giving thanks to God for a life and carrying the deceased to the cemetery and praying for that God would receive this person into eternal life. That was the funeral for everybody. It would never have occurred to anybody to have the coach come give a talk about, or the next door neighbor, or the aunt, or the uncle sing a special song to personalize it. Those were probably too impersonal, but we've reacted to the too impersonal funeral by having one now that is almost all personalization. So that for a Christian, for example, the gospel can sometimes get obscured by the life story and anecdotes about the deceased. And what we want to do is to say that when Elizabeth, our sister, has died, she's been gathered up into the gospel, and the story of God's love and Christ's redemption carries her to eternity.
So maybe just to follow up, should we take steps to plan our own funeral?
I think we should, but I think we ought to do it less than we are prone to do at this point. I think sometimes we think, you know, I need to plan each and every aspect of my funeral because I don't want to be a burden on my family. But there's a theologian, Gilbert Mylander, who has written an interesting Christian theological piece titled, I Want to Be a Burden on My Family. And what he's saying there is that the work of caring for those who have died, including the work of helping to pick the best scriptures to read and the pastor thinking of the things that she or he should say at the funeral, that this is holy work, and it's a part of actually of dealing with our grief to care for the dead. And so if we take away that holy work from our children or our loved ones too much, I think we deny them the benefits of actually participating and caring for us at the point of our death. Now, none of us wants to leave our children with a financial burden, and sometimes families can get into squabbles about what ought to be done at a funeral, and so some reasonable planning and guidance on the financial matters and basic orientation, I think, is good.
Good insight. We're going to continue our discussion more in a moment as we talk a little bit about one of the things that Thomas Long has talked about in his book, The Good Funeral, is about the importance of coherence in a funeral service. We'll get to that a little bit. We'll talk about, you know, why do they call them undertakers? And we'll get into more about, you know, how we handle grief and how we accept that and work through it. We're talking The Good Funeral, Death, Grief, and the Community of Care. And Tom Long is a professor of preaching at Emory University, and he's co-written this book with Thomas Lynch, and he's our guest today on Connecting Faith. We've got some copies to give away. The number is 877-933-2484. We'll do a drawing at the end of the hour, as we often do. 877-93-FAITH. And if you have a question for Tom, you're welcome to join in. Maybe talk about what experience worked well for maybe your family or friends, or maybe if you recently attended a funeral, just have some questions or some thoughts about that. Feel free to join in, 877-93-FAITH, or if you want to just go online, it's myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. There's an email link there, and we'll get to your question in just a moment. A day coming that all those who are followers of Christ look forward to with anticipation, the day when there will be no more tears and sorrow and no more death. But in the meantime, there is a journey that we all take. This life, only one life, will soon be gone, right? And so what happens at that time of death? We're talking about the good funeral, death, grief, and the community of care. And we're hearing today from Tom Long, who is a professor of preaching at Candler School of Theology at Emory University, and he's a popular preacher and a best-selling author, and some of his books, including accompanying them with Singing, The Christian Funeral, and The Witness of Preaching, the one we were talking about today, The Good Funeral. Now, Tom, before we maybe talk a little bit about coherence, which I want to get your perspective on, maybe from a practical and, I guess, operation standpoint, what things must be done when a loved one has passed? I mean, there's some basics I guess we probably know, but...
That's right. First of all, it's necessary when someone has died to prepare, care for the body. It's become kind of the automatic move in our culture for someone else to prepare the body, and this is where the funeral home comes into play, although there is a movement among some these days to do home funerals and to do a family prepares its own dead for burial, and then in the days after the death, the family needs to carry the deceased to the place of disposition, to the grave or the crematorium or wherever the final disposition of the body will be. Sometimes that's a grave, and sometimes that's a donate the body to medical science. But all bodies need to be carried somewhere and taken care of. And then in the days after this is done, one can expect a period of mourning or grief. And Different traditions have different customs. We think of the Jewish tradition of sitting Shiva, for example, which takes 7 days of formal mourning and then a whole year of grieving practices. And some Christian traditions have these very formal patterns of grieving. All Saints Day, for example, on the Christian calendar in November is often a time when the dead who have died in the previous year are remembered and mourned. So there's the practicality of preparing the body and taking it to the place of disposition. There's the preparing oneself for a time of grief and remembrance and mourning.
Talk about the term, you mentioned funeral home. There's funeral directors. We call them undertakers. Talk a little bit about that word.
Well, whenever I talk to funeral directors, I tell them that I'd like to take away their title as funeral director and to give them a more noble title, which is the original one, undertaker. The funeral director is a kind of modern neologism, an invention of terms that puts the funeral professional in the position of actually directing the funeral. But speaking from the point of view of a Christian pastor, we've been doing funerals in the Christian church for hundreds of years, longer than there have been so-called funeral directors. What we need out of the funeral professionals is someone who will undertake the responsibility of helping us do our own rituals. What do we need from them? If we're not going to prepare the body ourselves, then they are in the position to take care of the body and prepare it. If we don't have a horse-drawn cart or a wagon, we need their hearse to help carry the body to the place of disposition. And sometimes their experience with how to handle outside guests coming in, with how to handle the logistics of getting to the cemetery and that sort of thing. Those are valuable tasks that they do, and we ask them to undertake those tasks, not to direct them, but to undertake them.
Do most pastors get along with an undertaker? I mean, do they have good working relationships generally?
Well, it's an interesting thing. If you ask pastors about funeral directors or undertakers in general, and if you ask funeral directors about ministers in general, they all have a long list of complaints. But if you ask them about the funeral director down the street with whom they work, or the set of pastors with whom the funeral director works, they have almost nothing but praise. So the local relationships seem to be good. The larger images seem to be sometimes negative.
Which I guess is probably true in the population at large too, right? I mean, it's sort of like we like
right.
our congressmen, but we don't like Congress in general, right?
That's exactly right. Same thing.
And is it because there have been misuses and abuses in the past, or that it's the costs go up, or what are some of the reasons?
Yeah, I think if you take, for example, the funeral industry side of things, in 1963, a woman named Jessica Mitford wrote a very powerful indictment of the funeral industry called The American Way of Death. And a lot of her arguments about the funeral industry have gotten into the popular mind about what funeral directors are. They come in at the time of death and they take advantage of the grief-stricken, and they're out for nothing but a dollar, and they'll do things that are unnecessary, sell you merchandise that you don't need. The fact of the matter is there are some funeral directors who will do those things and have done those things. The truth is that the vast majority of them, they're in business and they do have to make a profit, but the vast majority of them see what they do as a kind of ministry. And they are very much in the posture of taking care of grief-stricken families. Since Jessica Mitford's book, the Federal Trade Commission has required that if you walk into a funeral home and ask to see the actual costs of various services, they have to provide for you a list. So there are some consumer protections that have come into play since she wrote that are, I think, quite helpful. But for the most part, your neighborhood funeral director is in the business of knowing you and caring for your family in the time of need. Now, ministers, have sometimes aggressively used funerals to try to recruit membership in their church, or have done funerals for people that they don't know and have, you know, have been completely impersonal in the way that they do them. Or they've been unavailable when needed, or they don't care for people after the funerals. There are some clergy abuses as well. But I would think and would hope, for the most part, most local pastors are eager to give gospel comfort in the time of need and the time of grief.
Do you, you've probably done a funeral a time or two where you didn't necessarily know the person. Is that a challenge when you were the sort of, you know, token clergyman at the funeral?
Yes, it is a challenge, but it's not an insurmountable challenge. One of the things that a minister ought to do is, if possible, you come onto the scene a day or two before the funeral, and you sit with the family at the funeral home or at the home, and you listen to the stories that they tell about the person who has died. And as you listen to those stories, you get a sense of who this person was and what they mean. And then the task is not simply to repeat those stories, but to be able to say, what does this life mean when we see grace refracted through it, when we see it in the context of the love of God and the story of God? That's the task that the minister has, of articulating the gospel story and then this person's story in the context of the gospel story.
Let's take a call here. We've got a break coming up, but we can at least get the call in, maybe not get the full answer at this point. Peggy in the Detroit Lakes has a question for you about planning and grief. Go ahead, Peggy.
Hi, Neil, and hi, Tom. Thank you so much for this subject today. I do have a fairly quick question. I'll try to word it concisely here. The question I have is, you had addressed earlier the fact that if the deceased has already planned out their entire funeral, it doesn't allow the bereaved afterwards to go ahead and work through some of their grief. But I've run into some cases that the bereaved were not able to work out the simplest of things for the funeral itself after the service, when the one that had passed away had not planned it out. And I was wondering how much is too much so that the bereaved, in this case, don't end up at each other's throats afterwards.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And I think I want to answer that in two ways. The first way is that I think every case is different. And if, for example, you are planning your will and you know that your children don't get along, you might want to specify Janie gets the sofa and Johnny gets the china cabinet. If you know they get along, you might want to say the children after my death will pick out from my possessions what they would like. So you know, if you think your family is not going to be able to work together, then you might want to be a little bit more directive in terms of what you have. The other is, I think we can trust most church traditions to have already in place the language and structure of a good funeral, and we actually don't have to improvise our own funeral. So our children don't have to plan it, and we don't have to plan it. The Methodist Church, if we are part of the Methodist Church, or the Presbyterians, they have a service that is beautiful and reverent, in which the story of the person's life can be told in the context of God's story.
We'll follow up maybe a little bit more on that in just a moment. I want to invite you to join the conversations. We talked The Good Funeral with Tom Long today, professor of preaching and co-author of the book The Good Funeral. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number. It's 877-933-2484, and we'll continue in just a moment. Talking about the journey from here to there and what that looks like. It's summed up well in an insightful book called The Good Funeral, Death, Grief, and the Community of Care. One of the co-authors with us today, Thomas Long. Tom is a professor of preaching and an author. He's written, actually, some time ago, he wrote accompanying them was singing The Christian Funeral. And out of that came a friendship with Thomas Lynch, and they together have written The Good Funeral. And we've got some copies to give away. You can sign up for the drawing at 877-93-FAITH. Tom, we were talking a little bit about our caller, Peggy, was asking about how much to plan, how much not to. And you said the church has a structure in place. And I know you address in the book the importance of coherence in a funeral service. So let's talk about structure and coherence. What does that mean and why is it important?
Okay. Well, sometimes I think we think about funerals, and we also think this way about Sunday morning worship sometimes, that it's just sort of a series of beads without a string. But properly understood, a funeral is a piece of drama, and it has a kind of intrinsic structure and meaning. Sometimes I think about it as a drama that tells three stories at once. The first story is the practical story. Elizabeth has died. Our great-grandparents would have taken her home and placed her body on probably the kitchen table or the dining room table and prepared her body, washed her, and dressed her in a funeral garment, would have put her in a coffin, and then, since there was no embalming in those days, within a day or two would have carried her to the backyard, to the family cemetery, or to the churchyard, to the church cemetery, or the town cemetery. So there's the practical story, and it involves a journey from the place where one dies to the place of farewell. The second story is the God story, the holy story. And for Christians, it had a kind of beautiful symmetry to it. Elizabeth was washed in baptism when she began her Christian life. We wash her body now in death. She was clothed in a baptismal garment when she was baptized, and now she's clothed again in the garments of baptism. We walked with her through life, singing with her and feeding her and bearing the burdens of each other's lives in her Christian life. And now we bear her body on the last mile of the way to give her into the hands of the God who gave her to us. So for the Christian community, the practical story also became a baptismal story about we're accompanying Elizabeth, who's a saint, a baptized saint of God, as we give her back into the hands of the God who created her. And then along the way, we're telling Elizabeth's story. We're remembering her and giving thanks for her life, even the hard places in her life. And we're praying for ourselves and our grief as we feel her loss as we move along the way. So all of that has a kind of choreography and a kind of dramatic structure. It's not just hymn and prayer and scripture and tell a story about Elizabeth, but it says Elizabeth's traveling to be with God. All of it does.
So is the grave side part of the service as important as, you know, what happens in the church? Or, I mean, sometimes those are done, privately?
Yeah, they have become now. Originally, the movement would have been from home to grave, and if you went into the church building at all, it was a way station along the way, along the pilgrimage, to get out of the weather so that you could pause for a moment to have scripture reading and sermon and that sort of thing. But it was just pausing in a pilgrimage that goes from home to graveside. In the 19th century, though, we began to worry that the dead were poisoning the atmosphere. There was a theory that dead bodies gave off a gas called miasma. And so there was a movement to get the dead out of town. And cemeteries were built on the outskirts of town so that the dead would not be among the living and wouldn't pollute the atmosphere. And when that happened, we began to have to travel a long way to get to the graveside. And so sometimes people would not make the whole journey. They'd just go to the part in the church and then go home. And then the graveside service became sort of movable. It got detached from the total dramatic structure. And so the normal practice among many suburban communities today in America is to do whatever you're going to do at the grave or the crematorium first and get the body taken care of privately, and then you gather in a church or a funeral home for a disembodied memorial service. And it becomes difficult to maintain the sense of dramatic structure that's there in moving toward the place of farewell when you're doing the act three before you do act one.
So to have a disembodied sort of a celebration of life, that's, I mean, it's okay to celebrate life, but we're maybe losing a bit about our theology of the body.
Exactly. If you gather in a funeral home or a church and say that what we're going to have here is a celebration of life, and Elizabeth is not going to be present because the presence of her body would be a downer when we're trying to celebrate the good things about her life, is I think a misunderstanding of what's happening here. The celebration of life that comes out of the great faith traditions, including Christianity, is not a giddy pretending that the person did not die. It's a hopeful confidence that declares, even though she is now dead, her death does not break off her relationship with God or with the rest of the community. She is now in the communion of saints. And so we can grieve, but we don't grieve, as Paul says, we don't grieve as those who have no hope.
Well, this brings up a question which I know you get a lot. Roger is calling in from Isanti, and we want to get your perspective. Roger, go ahead. You're on with Tom Moore. Tom Long, sorry.
Hi. I'm just kind of interested in your particular view of cremation and its biblical foundation.
Yeah. I think that there has been a lot of theological rethinking in the last 40 or 50 years as the cremation rate has risen, and every Christian tradition has now moved to the place that the process of cremation itself is a perfectly legitimate form of bodily disposition. The last to get on board with that, I would say, would be the some evangelical groups were uncomfortable about what this might mean in terms of not honoring the body. If you burn the body, is this a dishonoring of the body that God gave us? And also, Roman Catholic Church was very slow to get to the place that cremation was permissible. We're now watching both evangelical groups and Roman Catholic groups move to the place that cremation is a perfectly acceptable form. You know, what happens in the burning of the body is really simply an acceleration of what happens when the body is placed in the earth and it decays in the earth. It oxidizes in the same way. It's just a matter of speed when you do cremation. What is of more concern, I think, for faith traditions is not the fact of cremation, but what it means to people to cremate. If you ask people, why would you have cremation, many people will say that they do it for economic reasons or ecological reasons. But if you press a little bit harder, actually most people do it as a matter of convenience. And if the body is a hassle to us and cremation is simply a way of just cremate them with the emphasis on just, it's probably an avoidance of the holy labor of caring for the dead. So it's a question of what it means rather than the brute fact of cremation itself. I think that's theologically important.
It does shed some light into what our attitude toward life and death is today, isn't it? I mean, that has pretty dramatically changed over the centuries.
Yeah, it really has. And the notion that you mentioned earlier of embodiment, it's curious to me that when someone's pet dies, a cat or a dog, they often give more attention to the care of the body of the dog or the body of the cat than they do to the body of their mother or their brother-in-law. And I think that the body is not as if we're a soul trying to escape from the body like the Platonists believed. The Christians were against that. They thought that God had breathed God's own breath into dust and created a human being that's a unity of body and soul. And so the body was the temple of the Holy Spirit. It was sacred and to be honored. And so any practice that, you know, I don't care about the body. That's just a shell. Let's get rid of that. That's not really true to the Christian or Jewish faith traditions.
Tom Long is my guest today. We're talking about the Good Funeral, and we can take your calls. If you'd like to sign up, we'll get some copies of his book to give away. It's 877-933-2484. Talk a little bit more about maybe just what advice you have in terms of how we accept and work through grief. We talked about that, you know, that time of mourning. You know, even just the idea of cremation, that it just speeds it up. I mean, we don't like to take too long at anything, it seems like.
Yep. Well, I think one of the things that's happened that's been unfortunate is to think of grief strictly as an emotional response to death. And it does have powerful emotions connected to it. But what grief really is that the story that we have been telling about our lives, that we have a certain narrative that makes sense out of our lives, and suddenly one of the primary characters in the narrative is no longer present with us in the way that they were. I've lost my husband. I've lost my wife. I've lost a child. And the story that makes sense of my life suddenly now no longer has that person present. And so what stimulates grief is not just an emotional surge, but a loss of meaning. And we have to re-knit a narrative together. That's why the great faith traditions insist on telling the story of hope, that and the story of hope as regards the one who has died, that this person is dead, but is not lost to God. And this person is dead, which changes our relationship with them, but doesn't destroy it. This person is present in the communion of the saints as they gather around the throne to praise God. And so the retelling of that story and the reminding ourselves of that story is an intrinsic part of knitting together the raveled sleeve of care, as Shakespeare would put it, of mending our grief.
You alluded to earlier that sometimes a pastor can, you know, look at a funeral service as an opportunity to recruit whatever. But
yeah.
So, but you do need to talk about what life means, right? I mean, that to not do that is to sort of not maybe fulfill your obligation as a pastor, right?
Yeah, I think there's a tightrope to be walked here. I think sometimes pastors will use the occasion of a funeral to do an aggressive form of evangelizing that they wouldn't do on another occasion. This can take advantage of the emotional vulnerability of people. You really wouldn't, as a pastor, I would not think that you would want somebody to make a conversion move simply because they were vulnerable. You want them to make a conversion move because they feel touched by the love and the grace of God. And so if it is one's tradition at every service to make sure that the appeal of Christ is articulated and people have an opportunity to make a decision, then at a funeral it's appropriate to do something of the same thing that one would do on every other occasion. But I think it's a tipping of the teacup if you pick out funerals as those occasions in which you get particularly aggressive and appealing to people's vulnerabilities. One of the ways that I challenge pastors to think about this is funerals are some of those occasions when strangers come into the household of God, that there are people there in church who are not there on other occasions. So what's our responsibility? And biblically, we have a number of responsibilities, but one of them is hospitality to the stranger. And what does hospitality look like at a funeral? I think for many people who come in as strangers to the church, they have no idea what we're doing. They don't know what the story we're telling. They don't know the scriptures we're reading. They don't know the prayers we're praying. And so a kind of invitation to them to understand what we're about becomes a kind of more holistic form of evangelism. So that my goal would be they would walk away and say, wow, see what hope they have, see what love they have. And I was a participant in a drama that I didn't even know about before I came in here.
Thomas Long is a Bandy professor of preaching at Candler School of Theology at Emory University, and has authored many books, including Accompanying Them with Singing, The Christian Funeral, The Witness of Preaching. The one we're referencing today is he's co-written with Thomas Lynch, called The Good Funeral, Death, Grief, and the Community of Care. And we'll have more in just a moment.
In a Bible cracked and faded by the year.
We've been talking about how we honor and recognize the story of God, the story of hope in our lives, and how our lives have meaning. In fact, my guest today, Tom Long, has talked about that a funeral needs to have a sense of movement and a sense of meaning. He's co-authored the book, The Good Funeral, Death, Grief, and the Community of Care. What do you mean by the sense of movement and meaning?
Well, I think that just at a very practical level, what we mean by a funeral is the carrying of the deceased from the place where they died to the place of disposition, to the grave or to the crematorium. And that journey is a basic human necessity. Human beings have been doing that ever since there's been death, ever since there have been human beings. We don't leave the dead among the living. We take them to a place of disposition. So there's movement there. But the great faith traditions have recognized that that practical movement is also symbolic of our journey through life. And so moving from here, the place where we died, to there becomes moving from this life to the next. And that journey symbolizes our traveling to be with God.
In fact, we'll get to Jill's question in a moment. But I know in the book you talked about even working with a funeral director, quote unquote, who wanted to sort of, have the casket stage left or whatever. And you had some opportunity to redirect it, sort of take over the direction there.
That's right. When I wrote my first book on funerals, the irony was that the first funeral I went to after the book was published was my own mother's funeral. And I wanted to live out the insights that I had discovered in writing that book. And I got into a kind of a tussle with the funeral director, who wanted to roll my mother's casket from the preparation room across the front of the chapel area and to park it in the middle like a sofa at a furniture store. And then when the funeral service was over, they'd roll it out the other door to a waiting hearse and take her to the cemetery. And we got the change that we wanted. What we did was, instead of rolling my mother across the front like that, we brought my mother's casket in the same way that everybody else came in who worshiped. She was coming to worship. She's a part of the community of faith. And instead of being sideways at the front, we rolled her up to the front, but left it in the posture of worship. And in fact, the old rubric says the casket should be head first if it's a minister and feet first if it's a lay person, because that's the posture that you would have been in a regular worship service. And so we brought my mother to worship, and when the service was over, we turned the casket around and accompanied her back out the door of the chapel with everybody else and on to the grave where we buried her.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Jill here. We've got a few minutes left. Jill has a comment about a funeral done differently. I guess, Jill, you're on with Tom Moore. Go ahead.
Hi, Tom. Neil.
Hi.
Yeah, I just had a quick comment that, I think there's so many people nowadays that don't really realize that you don't have to do things the way tradition is done. My mom died a year ago from cancer. She died at home surrounded by all of us. We cared for her in the last 6 weeks of her life. She died surrounded by her grandchildren and her children and her my dad. And after she died, after we'd spent some time with her, the five daughters, we all bathed her and dressed her. She was not embalmed. We kept her in our home for 3 days. You know, by law, she has to be buried before the end of the third day. And
right.
We brought the casket to our home, to my parents' home, and we placed her in it, and all her children and grandchildren carried her to the hearse, and we all went out to the cemetery, and we buried her at sunset. And then her funeral service was scheduled to get people in from out of town, so it was scheduled actually 2 days later. But, you know, her body was not necessarily present, but we honored her. Her picture and everything else was up at the front. We celebrated her life as a very strong Christian woman and a very active member of the community, just like she'd always been. And she, although her body wasn't there, it was absolutely beautiful what we did with our family. And the funeral director really kind of didn't know what to do with us when we told him all what we were going to do. But, you know, people, I don't know if people really understand that there are other ways that you can do things. You don't have to do everything necessarily the tradition. And it was absolutely beautiful. And, you know, we have children that are any age from a baby all the way up to, you know, teenagers and young adults. And it was absolutely beautiful as a family to partake in all of that.
Okay. Well, what I would say about that is that I think you and your family know what I'm talking about when I say that this is holy work. That when you bathed her and when you placed her in the casket and you took her to the place of burial, that's a holy labor, and it has a powerful witness and a powerful meaning. And you actually say that you don't have to do things in the traditional way. The interesting thing to me is that you actually did things in the oldest tradition that we have. It's the newer things that are departure from this great tradition of caring for the dead, of walking with them. The title of my first book on funerals is called Accompany Them with Singing. That comes from a 5th century Christian document that says, in the deaths of the saints, accompany them with singing, walk with them to the place of farewell, singing and praying as you go. And that's what you did. And when you had the service afterwards, you know, because you did this fairly quickly because you didn't embalm, that's perfectly wonderful. And what you do is, when people come who could not be there for the actual burial, you remember the embodied person whose life you celebrate and whose memory you cherish. And it's not a disembodied person that you're remembering. You're remembering a real life of a person who put one foot in front of the other in obedience. So blessings on you for what you did there.
Tom, thanks for that the good word, too. Just a couple minutes left. Reminds me, I guess, to ask, what observations would you have for those of us attending a funeral or a visitation? How could we maybe better respond, make it more meaningful?
Well, the statistics indicate that attendance at funerals is down, and attendance at wakes and visitations is slightly up. And I think that's because we know that we can speak to the bereaved, at the mourners at a visitation, but we don't know what we're doing at a funeral itself, unless it's somebody we were really close to, a close friend or a family member. And I think that we ought to go to funerals, even if we were not intensely close to the person who died, to be there, to sing, to pray, to walk with them to the grave. All that becomes a part of acting out this Christian drama. This is a great piece of Christian theater, and we all have parts in it. And not to show up is not to be able to, you know, perform this drama, this great witness to the gospel. So I think we ought to go to more funerals.
Well, we've learned some good insight today about the good funeral, death, grief, and the community of care. And in Tom Long's book that he's co-written with Thomas Lynch, you'll find some good insights and just some real stories, too. Just a little bit of history and a little bit of encouragement. And you can find that. We've got some copies that we'll do a drawing for here shortly. And, Tom, is there anything that you recommend? Maybe is there a website or something if people want to just pursue this a little more fully?
Well, if you'll my co-author, Thomas Lynch, is a funeral director in Milford, Michigan, and he's put some resources on his website. If you can get to it by Googling Lynch and Sons, and then go to the website, and he's got books and other resources on that website.
Thomas Long is a Bandy Professor of Preaching at Candler School of Theology at Emory University. And he's authored a number of books, including Accompany Them with Singing, The Christian Funeral, The Witness of Preaching, the one we're talking about today, The Good Funeral, Death, Grief, and the Community of Care. Tom, I so appreciate your good insights today and your wise words, and look forward to perhaps chatting again down the road.
Thanks for letting me be with you.
If you missed part of today's program or you'd like to pass it on to a friend, we post our podcasts up online on the website after the show, and they're all shareable. So you can just go to myfaithradio.com, click on the Connecting Faith show page, and you'll find this audio and others there as well. And pass it on, listen to it again. And thanks for listening today.